Technorama, special interview with Kevin Schindler from the Lowell Observatory, part 3 of 3.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
New Horizons has gone past Pluto. Where's it headed next?
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here, your flight crew, Chuck and
Craig. Hello and welcome to Technorama, the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. If you're a new listener, thank you for joining us. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. We appreciate you giving us your time. I am Chuck Tomasi, and with me as always is Craig Stepp. How are you, Craig?
I feel spacey. Like, space.
You're always spaced out.
That space between my ears. Something like that.
We have a special program today. In May of 2016, we went to the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona. The resident historian, Kevin Schindler, was kind enough to give us a whole lot of information about the past, present, and future of the observatory, as well as a little personal insight. It was a lot of fun, and we had a very full day after this interview concluded.
We were also joined by Keith Lane and Ben Raggaton from the TG Geeks. You'll hear their voices throughout the series. They were kind enough to drive us from Phoenix to Flagstaff and back, which is good because Chuck and I just came off a very long work week at a conference our company hosts in Vegas, and we were not exactly up to the task of driving for a couple hours. If you're a listener to both shows, you're going to hear the same material twice, perhaps edited slightly different. So it's kind of like a challenge to each of us.
Spot the differences.
That's right. While Keith brought his brand new recorder, but unfortunately it suffered a technical difficulty and we had to loan him our recording as a backup.
Yeah, so if it sounds like I'm a little tired at the beginning of the interview, that's why. Like I said, we had a lot of stuff to soak up, and we're breaking this up into three parts of roughly 30 minutes each. So if you're jumping in the middle, you may want to go back to our site at chuckchat.com/technorama and listen to the other parts. Otherwise, sit back and enjoy.
How did you get involved in all of this?
I was going to say, yeah, what's your background?
Luck, I guess, is the big thing.
What did you go to school for?
I grew up in Ohio, and just like, you know, if you go back and look at life and why you went into things you went into, it seems like a lot of people had something happen. And when I was 7, I remember finding this, I was out blackberry picking.
And you had a rake hit you in the head. We were making jokes about that.
Yeah. Not that at that time, but probably someone else, which would explain, that would explain a few things. But but I was out blackberry picking, and I found this rock that had these like shells in it. And then I found another piece, and I put it together and jiggered it around, and actually fit together. And I took home, my dad shellacked it, and I still have it at home. But I got that, and then I talked to my teacher at school, and he said, oh, those are fossils. And so I started studying what fossils were, and I went to school to study paleontology because of that rock I found picking blackberries. And so I went into science, I liked it, and I went, the college I went to because that's where my high school earth science teacher went to, and he was like the best teacher, so I wanted to go there. So I went into paleontology. I worked in a museum in Florida for several years, paleontology, moved out to Arizona, and they didn't have any money at the time at the museum, but they had a job here. And I wanted to eat something, anything.
Had a strange addiction to food, shelter, and clothing.
And so I started working here, giving tours. And then through the years, probably mostly by attrition, everybody else leaving, and they had nobody else. So like, okay, Kevin, he can do, okay, you're in charge of the program for a while. So I managed the outreach program for years, and I always liked the historic components. But I mean, I like everything here. But I did that for almost 20 years and then decided it was probably a good time to refocus a little bit. I want to do some more writing. And so now I'm the historian. And so I get to talk about this stuff and write about it. And it's fun because, you know, I enjoy all the old stuff, but, you know, I see what our astronomers are doing today, and they're making tomorrow's history and making historic discoveries. And so to be able to... you know, go out to the telescope on any given night mm-hmm. and watch them in action, or to, you know, go to meetings and hear them announce this stuff before it goes public. Wow. And to help plan to get the word out and write press releases and to talk to you guys about the legacy of all this. It's, you know, I get paid for this stuff.
Yeah, that's what you do what you love.
Yeah, and that's life's so short. You gotta, you should do what you should love.
So obviously, as you said earlier, you went into school for paleontology. What is it about astronomy itself that sparks your excitement? Because clearly you have a passion that's there that's beyond just the historic.
I think for me, it probably comes down to the thrill of discovery. I mean, mm-hmm. it feels to me like, I don't know if this is the case, but it feels like, you know, we Americans, we're explorers and adventurers. And there are other countries too, but that just, I can only speak for me as American, but there's this thrill of discovery and excitement. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was young, picking up that fossil was so cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's almost addicting to where, you know, I still get the itch to go fossil collecting or go look for minerals or go blackberry picking, or it's exciting to do mm-hmm. that. And so
you mentioned contact earlier, and that Jodie Foster moment when she catches the signal. It's my favorite moment of the film.
Oh,
it's the discovery.
It's a thrill of discovery. I remember when I was younger, I wanted to either go into paleontology or Egyptology. Egyptology, I read about Howard Carter's discovery of King Tut's tomb, yeah. and just, you know, seeing wonderful things, and then watching the old mummy movies, which were really cool.
Yeah.
And so, those
documentaries.
I didn't realize it at the time.
Yeah. But Howard Carter's birthday was just a couple weeks ago.
Oh, was it?
That's right. Yeah.
And those guys, I mean, it's still the thrill of discovery. And you know, astronomy is neat to me because there's still that thrill of discovery. And astronomy is one of those fields that technology has advanced so much. Like paleontology, you still got to go out and dig in the ground like you always did. But with astronomy, the tools of the trade, instead of a hammer and a rock and chisel, it's, you know, a telescope and those instruments. But the instruments are so much better. Like you, like the that picture that Hubble took, the deep space.
The
deep space photo.
Nebula.
And they. A different one, a deep space where they, you know,
they pointed at a seemingly blank spot and just discovered
thousands of galaxies.
And astronomers have been looking at all sorts of areas of sky, but by doing that over several days with this technology, looking at the same place others have, they discover this new stuff. You know, we sent a spacecraft out to Pluto, and, you know, the discussion of is Pluto a planet or not, you know, it's interesting what would have happened with that debate if the IAU hadn't reclassified Pluto yet. Because when New Horizons flew by, I mean, it's so cool because we still have 6 months to go on all this stuff coming back. But Pluto is pretty darn world-like with, you know, activity, geologic activity going on. Mm-hmm. And this is stuff that, you know, up until last July, Pluto was a point of light. And now it's a world. And we'll never go back. I mean, we'll never go back and just seeing its point of light. It's now this world. And,
put a face on it, so to speak.
Yeah.
It's got a heart.
Got a heart.
Pluto's face is on it.
Yeah, Pluto's face is on it. And so to me, it's that, I think it goes back to the thrill of discovery. And I like to write, and so it's fun to write about all this stuff, but it's just, you know, it's just kind of cool. We have astronomers still that go on occultations when, you know, we have something like Pluto, and they can determine when it's going to pass in front of this distant star. And when it does that, when it passes in front of that distant star, the light is blinked out. And using that technique, astronomers, including those here at Lowell, discover the rings of Uranus, the atmosphere of Pluto, mm-hmm. and a lot of other discoveries. And just last year, right before New Horizons, there was an occultation of a star by Pluto. And several of our astronomers were involved. And up to the last minute, they were doing updated analyses of exactly the best location to observe that, and calling not only ground-based teams, but we had a team on an airborne observatory, SOFIA, the Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy, and that has a it has a 100-inch diameter telescope on it, and it flies at 40-some thousand feet.
Wow!
And so at the last minute, they're calling up the plane saying, we need to go north 100 miles. and they were able to divert off up to the last minute and be at the optimal place to look at it.
Wow.
Talk about cool.
That's amazing.
And they have these occultations that they're still refining where to be to the last minute. And so we had some, like in the 1980s and 90s, that the bags were packed, but they didn't know exactly where they were going. They knew they were going to Australia or South Australia or New Zealand, but they didn't know exactly where they were flying in until the last minute. They got the best final numbers, and then, okay, we're going here.
Not the cheapest plane tickets.
No. And they would be, and then these things would be in the middle of nowhere. It's not like, you know, it's on the beach in California.
Yeah, we got 3 hours to be there. Oh, gosh, it's a 15-hour flight.
And this place is Las Vegas. Let's go.
Yeah.
That would never be the best place for any of us. Unless you're looking for different types of stars, you know, like on stage.
Right.
Yeah. Only after the EMP has gone off.
That's right.
So anyways, that still is such a big thing. And I mean, I can't speak for all of our astronomers, but I certainly know I've heard some of them answer that question. You know, what do they enjoy out of it? And some, it really is just advancing knowledge, but there's nothing
research purely for its own sake.
But there's nothing like being out there, you know, in a discovery. And some of the discoveries are those seminal events, like you discover a new planet, and some of them are just these, just like Clay Tombaugh did. He took these pictures of the sky, and then he's looking through the stupid eyepiece of a machine called a blink comparator, flipping back and forth. He's looking at hundreds of thousands of dots, looking for one that changed position.
Yep.
And he discovered Pluto within a year, and then he did the same thing for 14 years. If he hadn't discovered Pluto, he would be a footnote in history, this guy that spent all this time and made a nice record of the night sky. But no, he discovered Pluto. And so how many other scientists out there have spent their life doing this night in, night out, tedious work that have built our background knowledge? They didn't make any big discovery, but you know, our knowledge of how the universe works is so much better because they built on that. Mm. So it's really neat, and that's what Lowell has done. We have these great discoveries, but also this ongoing night in and night out. Look at the atmosphere of Jupiter and Neptune and how it changes year after year. So now we have a team that's been doing that for 30 years, and that's pretty good. That gives you long range understanding.
Technorama, the podcast for geeks, because geeks are better than cool. You don't hear someone say, "Get away from me, you cool person." Who's gonna have their 65-inch home theater system installed by the cool squad? Not me, that's for sure. How much cool cred do you have? Not enough to care about. Think you'll find any canned unicorn meat at thinkcool.com? It's just a park domain name. They don't even have roadkill in a paper cup. That's why you need to start listening to Technorama, because that's what geeks do. Go to chuckchat.com and listen to Technorama before you turn cool.
Hi, this is Gil Gerard, and you're listening to Technorama.
How did Clyde know it was a planet? Did he have to confirm that and say, "Oh, this isn't an asteroid or a comet passing through"?
Well, when they, you know, he had found a lot of candidates. Like, you know, he took a picture in the sky.
There's a lot of stuff moving out there.
He took a picture in the sky, waited a few days, and took a picture of the exact same place.
Right.
And the idea was that, you know, like if you're driving in a car and the ditch is flying by, but the trees on the horizon are going really slowly. Mm-hmm. The same thing with this. He was looking for a planet. And you know, they figured, you know, if this thing was really easy to see through a telescope, somebody would have discovered it. It's going to be just a faint dot, probably. And so if you take a picture of the sky, you're going to get all these faint dots, the stars and asteroids and planets and other things. So just like that, the ditch and the trees on the horizon, you know, in general, in a few days' time, stars are so far away, they're not going to move relative to each other. But something really close to us, like the ditch compared to the trees, mm-hmm. something really close that is in our solar system compared to those background stars, in a few days' time, it's going to change position. And so you take these pictures a few days apart, and then you look through a microscope eyepiece on these photographic plates, and you look at every single dot. Yeah. And on each pair of plates is an area of the sky about the diameter of your fist, about a 15-degree area of the sky. Mm-hmm. And depending on where in the sky you're looking at, there may be two or 300,000 dots in that one small area.
Tedious work to do this.
Oh, my God. And so you have to you put these things on this blink of Barrett machine, look through a microscope eyepiece so you can see those dots, and you systematically move across the plate. And this blink, it's a machine called a blink comparator. So you're looking through the eyepiece. Yeah, and you see a small section of one plate, but there's a mirror that's constantly flipping. So it looks at one plate and then the other, back and forth.
Right.
And so by that, you're able to quickly look at each dot to see if it's changing.
Detect any movement.
Right. And so that's the idea behind it. And so he saw a lot of dots to change position that were asteroids. Or he would see a dot on one plate that wasn't on the other. Then maybe it was a variable star. It was bright one day and not so much the other. Or maybe it was a piece of lint or whatever. And so...
I've discovered planet lint.
Right?
Yeah.
And so he had the main these main photographic glass plates. They were 14 by 17 inches. But he had a secondary telescope mounted on the main telescope that he took backup plates. So that if he saw a candidate on one, you know, on one pair of plates, then he would look at those backup plates to see if it was captured on there. Yeah, confirmation. And then, depending on how far it moved, the closer it is, the more it's going to move position from day to day. And so they were looking for a planet that was estimated to be beyond Neptune. So based on that, they could see about how far that thing would move. So, you know, I'm just throwing a number out there, but if it moved half an inch, say, versus 2 inches,
mm-hmm.
if it's 2 inches, it's something a lot closer to us.
Mm-hmm.
So they were looking at something. So when Tomba found this thing, it had moved about the right amount of distance they figured it should to be a planet located that distance. But they didn't want to announce it yet because perhaps it was a comet
right.
that's out there or something else. And so he discovered it at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon on February 18th, 1930, looking through that machine. And that night, you know, now that they knew where to look, now they could use the big telescopes to zone in on that area. So Clyde Tomba was real excited. He's 24 years old. Afternoon, he's looking at this thing, thinks he's found a planet. He goes and talks to the other staff. His boss, V.M. Slipher, says, don't tell anybody. Don't even tell your parents, which he didn't. And so Slipher says, go to the telescope, the big telescope, the Clark at night, and take a picture and see if you can resolve it as a disk or see if there are any moons or anything like that. And so Clyde has to wait till it's dark. So he walks downtown, you know, gets dinner, gets the mail.
Starts drinking. Not dark yet. Starts talking.
Yes.
And I know it's Tuesday.
And then it's cloudy.
Oh, man.
It's cloudy. And so he goes to see a movie. The Virginian with Gary Cooper at the Orpheum Theater, which
still how do you know that?
He's the historian.
This is great stuff. It's the personal side of it. It's this personal side that's so cool. I mean, here he's 24 years old. Don't tell your parents. Don't tell anybody. He's so anxious to go and take a picture, but it's cloudy. So he sees a movie. He goes outside. It's cloudy, and so you know he said he remembers just watching The Virginian with Gary Cooper and just. Gripping his hand, it was so tense, but he wanted to go outside and see. But it was cloudy.
Probably the only one in the theater.
Yeah,
all wrapped up.
Wow, and he's really enjoying this film.
Yeah. And so he had to wait till another night. And so they photograph it with larger telescopes. They study it for several weeks, realize it's more planet-like than anything else, and so decide to make the announcement on March 13th. So it's a few weeks later, and March 13th, they chose that day specifically because March 13th. 1781 is the date that William Herschel discovered Uranus. March 13th, 1855 is the day Percival Lowell was born. So they would make the announcement on what would have been Percival Lowell's 75th birthday.
Nice.
Nice tribute because Lowell's the one who thought it was there.
Yeah.
And so they make the announcement and to put Flagstaff on the map of the world, really. The first planet discovered in the 20th century, the first planet discovered in the United States. And it was big news. And so within, you know, immediately we started getting telegrams and letters. We still have several hundred in our archives here. Mm-hmm. It's great to look through that because you could look through those letters and not look at the date, but you can still get a sense of kind of when, because the names people are suggesting. There's a couple that suggest Lindbergh, because he's still on people's mind from his 1927 flight across the Atlantic Ocean.
That was my next topic, is let's talk about the name. I mean, obviously, planet face isn't going to work.
No.
Oh, boy, don't start that again.
Well, we started, you know, all these suggestions start flowing in, and our staff, it probably wasn't the top of their priority list. They want to try to determine an orbit, which is big for astronomers. So astronomers want to look at it, around the world want to look at it. But we're getting all these telegrams. And so
congratulations.
Right. Like I said, a lot of these, you can kind of tell the era. There are a lot that suggested peace or pax, which is, I think, the Greek god of peace.
Pax.
Because the 1930s was, you know, supposed to be the decade of peace. It didn't really end that way, but that's what they said. And so
I saw it,
there were lots that suggested female names, because it's about time, you know, females got the vote in 1920. Now they need to be represented in the heavens.
Venus is being outnumbered by the others.
Right, it's all in the Venus. And so we get all these suggestions. One of the most common suggestions was Minerva. Minerva was the goddess of knowledge.
Yeah.
And that made sense because they spent these years looking for this thing. But Minerva had already been used to name an asteroid. Yes. And so they didn't want to use that. Cronus was another one, which was one of the brothers of...
No!
The guy pursuing the Legends of Tomorrow.
Right. Yeah. So there were dozens of these suggestions. But another common suggestion was Pluto. And Pluto...
Lord of the underworld.
Pluto's the god of the underworld, the most distant, cold region. And that made sense because the planet was so far out there. Mm-hmm. And so... in May, I think it was May 15th, 1930, the observatory decided, you discover a planet, you get to name it. So they decided, you know, they were probably getting tired of everybody asking them, what are you going to call it? And
That planet.
And Percival Lowell's widow first suggested calling it after her, Constance. And then she suggested Percival. But they were able to get around that by saying, well, tradition is Roman gods or goddesses. So they decided on Pluto, and they attributed the first suggestion to Pluto. A lot of people suggested it, but the first person to suggest it was an 11-year-old girl, Venetia Burney, who was over in England having breakfast with her grandfather. And her grandfather was reading the paper and said, hey, they discovered this new planet in America. And she said she had been apparently studying mythology in her class. And she said, I think they should call it Pluto because, you know, cold region. And so her grandfather contacted a friend of his, which worked in an observatory, who then, I almost said texted, he telegraphed, he sent a telegram to Lowell Observatory, which we still have, and said, suggest Pluto for name. And so the observatory, as near as they could tell, she was the first one to suggest it. So they gave her credit for it.
Truth to the myth that the PL Percival.
Yeah, so they like the name. The staff like the name, and all the planets have, you know, scientific abbreviations. Mars is a circle with the arrow pointing up, like the symbol for males.
Yep.
And Venus is a circle with the cross pointing down, like females. So for Pluto,
Earth has a bullseye or target. We're the crosshairs.
That's perfect. I never thought of bullseye. So they decided Pluto. You know, we'll use the combination of P and L's first two letters, Percival Lowell's initials.
All right, pay up.
And so, what a great tribute to Percival Lowell.
He didn't believe me.
Oh, I didn't say that.
Yeah. So that was kind of a clincher for them, calling it Pluto. And so that became a very popular name. When I first started working here, you know, our visitors always ask, do they name it after the dog? And so,
yes.
And so after hearing that about 400 times, I got a hold of the Disney, you know, they have a whole history thing there. And they told me...
My history guy call your history guy.
So I talked to them, and they didn't have any smoking gun that said, this is why they named it Pluto. But originally that dog was named, I think it was Rufus or Rover, I can't remember. But I think it was Rufus. But And it showed up in a couple of the early Mickey Mouse cartoons. But then in 1931, they changed the name to Pluto, the pup. And then it simplified to Pluto. And so the name Pluto for the dog, So that name came after the planet. And while they don't have any smoking gun that says Disney changed it because he was inspired by the planet or anything like that, I mean, Disney clearly was into science, and that was such a news item that it seems likely that it was changed it because of that. But
Walt was always cutting edge.
Yeah,
anything that was new.
Right.
Yeah.
So I can't go as far to say that was for sure, but it's pretty likely that's probably why he changed the name. And there was a little bit of controversy about it because at the time there was a laxative called Pluto Water. That you could get in a bottle.
Great.
And you can get these bottles on, you know, from antique stores now, Pluto Water. And so some people thought that was kind of funky, but it's kind of funny. So that's how Pluto got its name.
Cool.
And there's Astronomy Magazine, you know, their Sky and Telescope and Astronomy, they're kind of the magazines for amateur astronomers. They did an article a couple months ago about the naming of Pluto in astronomy. It's kind of cool because we have all these telegrams and letters. Mm-hmm. And this one guy, he said, I would name the planet Jean. I don't know what it means, but I have a daughter named Jean and she means the world to me. And so, you know, just all these cute, yeah.
You can name a star after her.
Yeah, well, we do. Yeah, we have that. You know, I mean, you know, it's kind of funny with the star naming because it's, you know, it's just crap.
It's an inherent thing.
Yeah, but, and yet, you know, it's still, I mean, I'm one of those guys that, you know, it's not real, but you know, it's one of those things. If you have money, buy a star and name it after somebody. It's kind of fun.
Yeah.
As long as you realize it's not a valid thing.
It doesn't mean anything.
But, you know, we have had...
Hey, my career on Mars, that means something.
Career on Mars.
Well, we have had, you know, people up here who, you know, they had, you know, I had one, their daughter was killed, and they wanted to honor her, so they bought a star, named it after her, and they wanted to look at it. Like, sure.
Yep. Okay. Yeah.
We can find it. So, and, you know,
it was just a... the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah, right. Oh, dang. Well, that's the thing. I mean, all these stars are like...
I'm sorry. It just went Nova.
Oh!
Now it makes lots of stars.
And so many of them are kind of faint. And, you know, and so, you know, it's kind of... it's. I don't know, somebody made some money off of it. It's kind of a joke.
When you register start, does it give you the coordinates?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you can figure. It's always like this 14th magnitude. Like, you can't even see it with a naked eye.
Right.
But, yeah, you know, you look through a telescope, get a star map, and, yeah, that's the one. That's it. Yep. So it's a, you know, it's that's a real thing. So,
road trip.
So you got it, so you could all have your own stars. I have an asteroid named after me, Kevin. I have an asteroid and a fossil crab named after me.
A fossil
How's
crab.
That for, yeah.
Yeah, I bought two
cool. Pseudo Ashula Shinmarai.
Mike has a property on the moon.
Yeah. He's got a
pair in there.
Well, you know, with the asteroids, we had our main guy for years was Ted Bull, and they discovered all these asteroids. And those are valid names. They give them numbers, but they give them names that are recognized, but they're still just kind of fun things. And so he named them after all the Beatles, you know, the Challenger astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people who work here, I have Kevin. His favorite. Cool.
There goes Kevin.
His favorite. What's the name of the person who owns the winery?
Gallo.
I mean, like, what's their? What, I mean, no, what's their title? Like,
Vintner,
is that what it is?
Yeah.
Anyways, his favorite vintner in California, he named an asteroid after that person.
Yeah.
And so. There's a lot of them out there.
So we know who to blame if the Earth suddenly gets hit by Kevin.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think
it's a bad.
I don't think it's an Earth approacher, though.
Yeah, there's something kind of negative about naming an asteroid out of the space shuttle Challenger. I'm sorry.
No.
To me, that seems a little dark.
Well, it's an honoring them.
Yeah. In the
end. I don't think any of them are like Earth approachers that would. Like,
well, that's the thing. Because that would be really depressing.
Yeah. Yeah. So
revenge.
Yeah.
Anyways, it's a, you know, it's a, that part, side of astronomy that's kind of a personal thing. It's just kind of a fun thing. And astronomers, those names are valid because that's by the official governing body of naming those. The stars, on the other hand, are just anybody can create a star registry. But you know, whatever. It's kind of cool. If you like that sort of thing.
Just out of curiosity, of all the discoveries that have happened in the field of astronomy. Is there one in particular that just geeks you out the biggest, or any kind, or a personal astronomical observation that you've had Yeah. Is there one that just really just shines and says, that was my favorite moment?
Seeing Kevin?
Yeah. I've never seen Kevin. You know, it sounds so simple. My favorite thing to look at is the moon. Because I love the history of spaceflight, human spaceflight, and the event and the exploration of it. That's my favorite thing to look at. But I think probably I've seen some really cool things like comets that look like, you know, the spheres going around, and you know, transit of Venus, which was really cool. I mean, it's nothing to look at, and yet it's not going to happen again for decades, 100 years, whatever, a couple hundred years. But I don't know. I think maybe I think that there are two things that I remember that are so simple. One was I was looking through a solar telescope with filter, a hydrogen alpha filter, so everything the sun looks red, and a plane flew in the field of view.
Oh wow, that's just bizarre.
And I thought that is so cool. And then it got me thinking about when you talk about UFOs, you know, what does that mean? If you're a bushman living in Africa and you saw a plane fly overhead.
Well, that's a UFO.
That's a UFO. I mean, so that was kind of neat because it got me thinking just about when you see things out of context, what it means.
Right.
And so I think the other thing was a couple of years ago we had annular solar eclipse when you know, the outside of it is still lit up. And we had something like 900 people up here at the observatory. Wow. It was a zoo. And way more than parking. We had a lot of people up here. And so we had all these telescopes set up all around campus. And, you know, it's neat. Everybody's able to look through, and it lasts long enough you can see it. And I was living up here with my family. This is 2012. And my wife came over to look through. She saw the lines and said, okay, I don't want to first make it to where somebody has to wait longer, but also I don't want to wait in lines. So she went back home. And, you know, during this time, you know, you could look through telescopes, but you can also project an image, like through a telescope onto a piece of paper.
That's what I usually do.
But another thing that's so cool that you don't realize is that the sun, when it shines through trees, it creates these tiny little images of the sun. And I was up looking for a place to see this, like on the ground or a side of a building, but there wasn't anything around. But it's kind of neat to see. So when I got home later on, my wife Gretchen, she showed me this picture she took. She got back, you know, way too many people here. So she walked the 200 or 300 yards back home. And the side of our garage is completely covered with these little eclipses of the sun.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I've seen that before. Was it in the 90s we had an eclipse? Well, I'm on the East Coast. And I remember seeing little crescent shapes.
And I don't think I have it on the phone. But it was, I just loved it because here, all us nerds are over here with these telescopes and geeking out, and my wife went back, okay, I don't want to see it. And it was just fabulous, the whole side of the garage. And so we took a picture, and the paper loved it. And I mean, it was just such a neat thing.
Yeah.
And so I think I like that also because of just the personal side of it.
Mm-hmm.
That it's, you know, in that case, you don't need an expensive telescope to appreciate what was happening.
Right.
But, I don't know. I've seen, in 20 years, I've seen a lot of awesome stuff, things through telescopes. But it always comes back to, like, the kind of the personal thing. I should say there's one more thing that was kind of neat. It was, I think it was 2003, and we used to have a living history program here at Lowell Observatory called Voices from the Past, where we dress up as dead astronomers and do a play. So I was Percival Lowell because I look so much like him. Yeah. And so this was our last night doing this program. And so we were done. And several of us went up to Percival Lowell's mausoleum and went inside. There's this great skeleton key to get inside. And we were doing a toast to Percival Lowell. We had a couple bottles of wine. We're doing a toast. And one of our guys walks outside. He says, oh my God, you have to come out here. 180 degrees of the sky was red. It was during when the sun was particularly active, and it was the Northern Lights.
Oh, you got the aurora up here?
And that's the only time I've ever seen it. Here we are.
We went to Alaska
and didn't see it. Yeah.
And this was
Who brought this?
And this was, you know, it was red. And here we are, Mars was up in the sky. you know, we're in Percival Lowell's mausoleum, and here's this eerie red
that
sky.
Wild.
It was really, it was, I mean, it gives me chills later on. But then there's a, I think it was a TV station in Phoenix, which is, you know, 120 miles south of us. They saw it and initially reported a fire north of town because the sky was all aglow.
Oh, yeah.
And nobody, I mean, there's been aurora this far south before, you know, occasionally, but I'd never seen one. That's the only time I've ever seen it. And we had, there were a couple during that time period, but, you know, it's only a few minutes if you're not there.
Astronomers dressed up as dead astronomers observing the aurora.
Under the influence of alcohol.
It was, yeah, it was, it was pretty funky.
What could possibly
go wrong? On the local
news. Yeah, that never happens.
<Silver lining.
laughs> So that, I don't
Let's
know.
Let's do
that,
it again next weekend, guys.
it was magical, I guess. And the longer time passes, the more cool it was, I think, so.
Nice.
Once again, we really appreciate Kevin Schindler from the Lowell Observatory for giving us his time out of his busy schedule. Elena Lane for coordinating the interview, and the entire Lowell staff for their generosity, knowledge, and sometimes patience for putting up with our antics. That's for sure. Thanks to Ben and Keith from the TG Geeks. You can find their podcast at tggeeks.com. You can also find our show at chuckchat.com/technorama, along with links to our other information. Be sure to subscribe and so you don't miss other parts of the interview, because there are three other specials we have coming up in our regular weekly show that is also broadcast live on YouTube.
Special thanks to our Patreon patrons for making specials like this possible. You can support this show by going to patreon.com/technoramapodcast. For as little as $1 a show, you'll get special after-show topics that nobody else in the whole world gets to hear.
And speaking of support, we encourage you to go support the Lowell Observatory through July of 2016, the one-year anniversary from the New Horizons flyby. They are raising funds to restore the Pluto telescope, yes, the telescope that they used to discover the planet all those years ago. It is still there and needs some TLC, so go to lowell.edu to find out how you can contribute.
Until next time, tell a friend about Technorama, and Craig is always ready with that binary high five. Go for it!
101.